I was asked to speak about friendship in Thomas Aquinas. Now, especially how to make friends. And Thomas Aquinas is highly theoretical philosopher. He doesn't really write about practical matters such as how to make friends, although he has some wonderful spiritual writings. He has accounts of friendship. So I'll explain a little bit about that, and then it will lead into the question of making friends. Right. So the first thing we have to ask in connection with friendship is, well, what is friendship? And the classical authors describe it as reciprocated love. Now, then that raises the question, what is love? And it's the wish of good to someone. You might say the wish of good to something that has a good. I'll give you an example. I have some wine. This is an example goes back to Aristotle. And I want to preserve it. And I open up the bottle and I cork it. I put it in the refrigerator instead of leaving it out uncorked, right? I'm taking care of the wine. I'm doing what preserves it, keeps it good and tasty and so on. Do I love the wine? Right, maybe when you're a kid, your parents would say, well, you like wine. You don't love wine, right? On the other hand, consider my dog Lulu. Lulu is hungry. I have to feed her, otherwise she will perish the way the wine would perish. So I feed Lulu. Do I just like Lulu in the way I like the wine? I'm taking care of her. It seems to me there's something that's more that's there. I'm actually tending to her good. It makes sense to say that Lulu has a good. I mean, it's not that I put the cork on the wine and put it in the bottle because that's good for the wine. It's the wine is now well taken care of. It's because I'm preserving it because I want to use it the next day. But for Lulu, there's a sense in which I'm really taking care of Lulu. So to wish good to someone, that's the classical definition of love, but you could say to wish good to someone or some being which has a good. So you can actually show love to a plant, I believe, but obviously it's not going to be the same kind of love that you'd show to a human being. So when you show love to someone who has a good, there's some kind of possibility of reciprocation. I think this possibility of reciprocation ends up being very important for love. We, in a certain sense, expect love to be reciprocated, right? If you smile at someone in the street, which is a very elementary act of love towards that person, you expect them to smile back. If you greet them, you expect them to greet you back. It's love is inherently reciprocal. That's a key insight of the philosophical outlook called personalism. And the reciprocity even applies to my dog Lulu. So I give Lulu some food and I expect her to wag her tail, right? Or she comes over and she nudges my hand when I'm sitting and reading a book. She expects me to pet her, and I start petting her, and she responds to the petting, doesn't she? Right? And you can actually feel in the dog what it's like to get scratched. That's one of the reasons why it's so soothing to pet a dog, because in a certain sense, you're petting yourself, your animal nature, because you feel it in petting the dog. When I raised a pig, how many here have raised a pig? What? A classroom of military-type people, and no one's raised a pig? This is a truism among pig farmers, that they love to sit, they love to stand in the sun and watch their pigs roll around in the mud. Because they actually feel what it's like to be relaxing in the mud by watching their pig. The reciprocity is working even in that context. Now, reciprocity is free, or it's kind of on fixed terms. If I do a favor for my wife, I know she's going to be nice to me, too. She'll say thank you. We have this thing going on where I make her latte in the morning and she bakes me bread in the afternoon, and we regard that as kind of a trade-off. It's obviously not like selling something in the marketplace. On the other hand, selling it would be on fixed terms. So reciprocity is very interesting because it really varies in degree of freedom. Right? And we think it's better when it's freer. I'll do something kind to a friend, and I won't care whether it's reciprocated. I'll expect it to elicit reciprocation. I'll regard it as some kind of weakness in friendship if it doesn't, but I don't count it up and keep track of how many good deeds I've done for my friend. Now, there's a kind of prejudice against reciprocation that arises from, I think, a certain misreading of the Christian tradition. So you know, are those parables that our Lord says when you give a feast, right? Don't invite your wealthy friends who invite you in turn to their own feasts, right? Invite the poor and the lame and the lepers and so on, and they won't be able to pay you back, right? But then what does our Lord say after that, right? He says something along the lines that your Father in heaven, who sees in secret, will repay you. Right? So the point of these parables about non-reciprocation is not that reciprocation has no place in love or that it's a lower form of love. It's rather that if we are doing a true deed of charity, we're doing it in relationship to the Father, and we're treating his children well because we also want to please him, and we expect that that is taking place in a personal relationship with the Father, and the Father is going to reciprocate, and that's actually right. We should look for God to reciprocate when we please him. So, let's see what I should cover here. So that's what friendship is. It's reciprocated love. And one of the most interesting things in Aquinas' account of friendship is his distinction between what he calls love of friendship and love of concupiscence. And these two loves can be reciprocated, so you can have a friendship that's based on a love of friendship and a friendship that's based on reciprocated love of concupiscence. Now, this of concupiscence is confusing. It's just a classification. So understand it as love which has the nature of concupiscence, love which has the nature of friendship. And here's how you're to understand it. So when we love, there's an anticipation of reciprocation. Another way of expressing that is that we think of the being or person to whom we show love as another self, as like ourselves. And we do good to this other person. It's as though we think what we would want done to us if we were in that position, right? And this is the basis of the golden rule and, right, do unto others and so on. So what that means in an interesting way is that when you show an act of love, there are actually two acts in that act of love. I'm going to take a simple case. I'm going to use this as an example of a certain kind of friendship. But my wife and I own a house in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. And we have a handyman, and his name is Mike. And he helps us in various ways in this vacation house, and we, of course, pay him. So there's reciprocation there. But when, for example, he's going to help us, say he has to move something or he has to install a dishwasher, I will think, how can I make this job easier for him? Right? Is there junk in the way that I need to get out of the way? Do I need to order something part he'll have handy? I'm kind of thinking of the job from his point of view, and I've done a lot of jobs around the house, as you have too, and saying, well, if I were in that position, right, what would make it more pleasant for me to do this job? Right? So even in something that's very simple as an exchange of services or services for money, there's some aspect of taking the other person's point of view. Right? Or when I do a good favor for my wife, say I make her that latte in the morning, right? I actually have just made one myself. And I've tested the quality of the coffee and so on, and you know, I'm a pretty good barista at this point, and I adjust it based on what I would want if I were making that second cup of coffee. So we're taking the other person's point of view. So this is important because in an act of love, there are actually then these two acts. One is a kind of recognition of the good of the person who's receiving the good that you're giving. And then there's a recognition of the good that other person is receiving. And it really goes beyond recognition. In some sense, it's a participation in that other person's wanting that thing as well. Okay. I make a really nice latte for my wife, even though I've just made one for myself. I'm appreciating it from the point of view of somebody who is looking for that first latte in the morning and you know, looking at the color and the texture and the flavor and everything. So there's an aspect of, if you want to call it that, desire for the good, this good that's being conferred, also as part of love. So that first act, that first element of love, which is for the person who gets the good thing, right? And if you want to spell all that out, it's a person who's a child of God, who's made in the image of God, who's a person with dignity like yourself, right? Who has all the goods that we have endowed, God has endowed us with many goods as human beings. We love that person, viewing that person as good in that way, right? And deserving other good things that we'd like to give them out of love, say the latte in the morning. So the first thing is for the person, the first act of love, and we call that love of friendship. That's for the person as receiving a good. But the love for the good is called love of concupiscence. Now, concupiscence means in Latin a kind of acquisitiveness or grasping. It's a sense that the basic idea here between love of friendship and love of concupiscence is love which is outflowing, right, which is abundant in a certain sense, and love which is inward taking. Like, I need clothing, it's cold outside, and I'll take that jacket, thank you very much. Or I'm hungry, we view that as a kind of pit, a hole inside, we're going to fill the hole with food, right? So that's this kind of grasping nature, and there's nothing wrong with it. We're built in that way with needs. We need to get things, to acquire things, in order to survive and flourish and so on. That's perfectly fine, but it's a different kind of love. So it's a very important insight of St. Thomas. He's building on Aristotle here, that in any act of love, there are two aspects. One is love of the person, which is love of friendship, for whom the good is going to be conferred. And the other is love of the good, which is a kind of participation, actually, in the viewpoint of the other person who's getting the good. Okay, and the first we call love of friendship, and the second love of concupiscence. Now, it's the next thing he does, and again, he follows Aristotle, but he builds on Aristotle in interesting ways. He's saying you can take either of those loves, reciprocate it, and you get friendship. So his basic distinction is between reciprocated love of friendship and reciprocated love of concupiscence. So what do I mean by reciprocated love of concupiscence? Let's take the relationship between myself and my handyman, Mike. Right? I have certain needs. Away from this house, I need to have things fixed. I need to have things taken care of. Right? And he has certain needs. Right? He has commitments he has to make. He has things he has to buy. Right? So he fixes something for me, and he does it well. Maybe he's available. He makes himself available. I appreciate that. And then I wire the money quickly to him as a sign of my gratitude. Right? So there's an exchange here of love. Now, what kind of love is that? Is that love of friendship, or is it love of concupiscence? Well, here's the interesting thing about this relationship, is that either of us, the moment we don't need the other person, is free to call it off. Right? Like, if I move into my vacation house for a couple of months and I'm capable of fixing things, I don't call him. He's not going to object. You know, you haven't called me in 2 months. What's wrong? Right? He understands that if I don't need anything, I won't call him. Right? The moment I stop needing him, then I stop calling him. Same thing in the other way around. Right? So if he has a big job, some kind of construction job, he doesn't need my work, I'll call him and ask him to work. I'll say, I'm sorry, I can't help you. And I'm not offended. There's a veto power that each of us has over the relationship. Right? Which indicates that it's really rooted in a certain kind of want of these useful things, which is a love of concupiscence. Aquinas points out that there are actually, again, he follows Aristotle, two types of love of concupiscence. One is love for useful goods, and the other is love for pleasures. Right? And the same thing happens with pleasant friends. I like to use the example of, you know, you could have drinking buddies or people play games together. I like to use the example of tennis partners. But if you're getting exercise on a daily basis, you would run several miles, or you could play tennis, right? Or golf, right? And why do you play tennis rather than run several miles? I know why I do, because I like playing tennis and I don't really like running, right? So if I have a regular tennis partner, right, we play every morning, right? And I don't see him for any other purpose. We just meet and play tennis. That's a pretty good example of a relationship, the basis of which is pleasure. We both enjoy it. We want to get our exercise, and we pick tennis over other activities because it's fun. But the moment which it stops being fun for either of us, we just stop meeting to play tennis. If I get much better than the other person, it's no longer fun to play matches with him, then I find ways of saying, you know, thank you, I'm busy, or I'm not going to play anymore, and we stop playing tennis. And he accepts this. Right? It would be absurd to say, well, no, you should play because it's fun for me. Right? That would be absurd. So in both a useful friendship and in a pleasant friendship based on exchange of pleasure, love of concupiscence for pleasure, there's a veto power that each friend has, and we take that for granted. But there's another kind of relationship where the love that's exchanged is love of friendship, and what you love is the person, and the goods are secondary. The goods are in the service of the person. Right. So what would be an example of this? Well, I use the example of my relationship with my wife. I think it's a very good example of that. Now, although I was invited once for one of these true love conferences at Princeton University, argued that the relationship between a husband and wife is not a friendship. There is a sense in which it is a friendship. So I'm contradicting myself in an earlier talk that's online, but both are true. I won't explain now why I think that both are true. But consider the relationship with my wife. Their exchange of useful pleasures, all the useful services all the time. The latte and the bread. You know, I fix things outside. She fixes things inside. You know, kind of standard division of duties around the household. There's also a lot of pleasantness. We like, you know, watching shows together or conversing together or being with friends together. But what's interesting about those is that we view them as traced to character. Like when my wife bakes me bread, I don't say, well, you know, how does this compare with Panera bread, right? I don't even raise the question. I view it as coming from her love for me and her desire to do something special, and I evaluate it accordingly. Or, this is very common when people are courting or dating, they are, say, enjoying each other's presence, and they ask the question, what is the basis of this? What's the source? Why am I liking spending time with this person? Right? Is it coming from good characteristics that they have, or maybe not? Or, you know, somebody's on the rebound and they're spending a lot of time with someone, and then their friend advises, well, what's going on here, right? Maybe you like spending time with this person because there's some need that you have that's being fulfilled by that, right? That would be a love of concupiscence. It wouldn't be a love of friendship. So it's a possibility of exchanging this love of friendship. So there is no veto power in that sort of relationship. Like, I can't just walk away from my, even though it is a marriage and there's a vow and so on. Let's take a good friend that I have. I can't just stop seeing him and say, I'm sorry, I don't really care to be your friend any longer. He'd want an explanation. I'd have to justify that. There'd be nothing I could point to and say, well, I no longer have X, and then therefore I have no longer have need to be your friend. Because my friendship was not with X, it was with him, and he's still alive. Right? So there's a sense in which that sort of relationship never ends. It never has any inherent reason for ending, except possibly a change in character of the person who's your friend. Right? So if they take a wrong turn and they break bad, well, then you may need to stop associating with them because they're no longer lovable, Aquinas would say. All right, so there, in the classical literature, Aristotle and Aquinas, there's a kind of tallying up of traits of this kind of relationship, the love of friendship. It takes time to form. It can't be formed quickly. It is immune to calumny. So if somebody says something that's critical of your friend, a true friend, you will resist it. You'll reject it. You won't believe it at first. Right? Because you have a lot of trust and confidence in your friend from a long time together. Also, it's pretty rare. Right? Most of our relationships on this classical view are reciprocal concern for friendship or for pleasure, not love of charity. All right, so that's what friendship is. And it's important to mark out these two kinds because that then helps to identify true friendship. But then the next question is, why is it important? And I'm going to leave some time for questions. We have to be out of here promptly at 8 o'clock. Is that true? Okay. So, first of all, a friend will tell you the truth. A flatterer tells what you want to hear. A friend speaks words to you that please you. A friend will speak words to you that may be very unpleasant to you, but they may be true. Secondly, we need reinforcement to do good. Right? How many people who've gone astray in some way, they say later, if they had a single friend who supported them, they wouldn't have done it. Friendship is tremendously strong, if it's a good friendship, against being led astray, going off the straight path. Friendship is good for your character in the sense that you know that one of the components of this true friendship is to be pleasant to the other person, and our moods change so much, and whether we're comfortable or not comfortable change so much, that to be constantly pleasant to others is actually very, very difficult to do, and you grow in character very much by being pleasant. So some great saints have said, you know, just smiling at someone can be a tremendous mortification, right? Friendship helps you to remember your past. Because friendship has this kind of inherent unending quality to it, it brings forward into the present things from the past. That's why all these maxims about keep old friends, make new friends, but keep the old. You'll find later in life that your friends from childhood still bring you back to childhood, right? Because they carry those experiences forward with you. You continue to be, in part, a child because of your friend who shares it with you. Augustine has a wonderful reflection on this character of friendship in Book 4 of his Confessions. Groups of friends foster a kind of democratic attitude because they don't take themselves seriously. They accept kind of the hard knocks that they get from one another, and each regards himself as one among many equal others. This is Chesterton's idea of the life of friends in a pub is kind of the seedbed of democracy. And then finally, I'm going to say this, and we can end, we can have some questions. Friendship is, it's the best way of doing good. In our society, we have this idea that the best forms of good are towards strangers. Right? Do a random act of kindness, as the bumper sticker says. But the most, the best types of doing good are highly articulate, highly refined. There's a lot of thought that goes into them and a close match between what you're trying to do and the person who receives the good. And this requires a great deal of familiarity and a recognition, so to speak, the political universe in which people live. All right, so that leads to the question of how you form friendships. I'm sorry I came in late, but I'm going to just leave you with some questions to think about, and then I'll take some questions from the floor. The first is this. Given this ideal form of friendship called friendship of true reciprocated love of friendship, how would you form it? What would be the best ways of forming? The second would be this. How many of those friendships should you try to form? What would be an ideal number? 2, 3, 5? Is there too many? Aquinas, in his account of friendship, traces human friendships back to friendship with Christ. In fact, he defines charity as charity, the Christian charity, as friendship with Christ. Is it truthful to speak of friendship with Christ? Christ is God. Can you have friendship with God? What does friendship consist in? Now, assuming that it is possible, how would friendship with Christ affect how you form and practice friendship with your fellow Christians, your fellow human beings? All right, so those are questions I want to leave you with, and we were going to break into small groups and discuss them, and I'm an idiot. So my wife tells me that many times every day, and I didn't need an independent confirmation of it, but I did receive it. So any observations, questions, comments? Yes?
So just out of curiosity, for that conference that you're at, what was your argument for why marriage should not be a friendship?
Well, okay, so here's if you say, okay, I'm going to form a friend, and one friendship I happen to form is with my wife, I think that's false. It's not as though we have this kind of realm of friendship and we pick one who ends up being your spouse. I think that there's another thing that's going on when you get married, and then that proves to be a friendship. So over time, the development of that is actually friendship because it has all these traits that I was mentioning. That other thing which is going on, I actually call mating for rational animals. It's actually coupling. It's you actually want to have children with the other person, right? So you want to get together, you want to have children, you want to raise children. And so that's really what's going on in marriage. I put it very starkly, like mating for rational animals, because it's so different from how people think of marriage in our society, right? So that got the point across. Yes.
So do you have any tips for discerning a true friendship from maybe one where you're both just getting mutual benefit that could be vetoed very easily?
Yeah, so one thing is to give tests. So this is Aelred of Ribeaux, who wrote a book called Spiritual Friendship. He's a monk, right, in the Middle Ages. He said, for example, say something confidential to your friend and say, keep this in confidence, right? And it's not that important, but it's also individual. So you'll find out if that secret gets out. A true friend will keep the secret. One who's not a false friend will not. There's a whole classical literature on telling a true from a false friend. Another way would become very, very, if you have money, to lose your money. Right. Or to become like Job. You know, just be very sick, maybe. Maybe you become disfigured. You know, injured in warfare, for example. How many people are going to come visit you in the hospital, right? Those are your true friends. Yes?
So I think you made a useful distinction. If I interpret it correctly, the love of the person versus the love of goods that the person can kind of get you.
Yes.
A little bit of a distinction between just what we would say like true love for the person versus more of a utilitarianist.
In the second, though, it's really love of yourself, but it's not selfishness. It would be a mistake to call it selfishness, because there is a regarding of the other person as another self. There is love for the other person. So you don't find in Aquinas this reduction of that kind of, say, the relationship I described with Mike, my handyman, as selfishness. It's actually it's win-win, it's reciprocal, it's social, it is love, but it's a different kind of love. But it's either reciprocal, each loving himself reciprocally, but it has a highly social nature, or genuine love of the other person. Yeah, but that's, if you accept that qualification, yes.
So utilitarianism, that would be more like a third.
It is a third. That's a very good point. So what's regarded as selfishness, or say Wojtyla in his book, Love and Responsibility, talks about this kind of coordination of egoisms, which can take place in a contraceptive relationship, he believes. That's a different thing. Right, that's even a corruption of this love of concupiscence, this useful friendship. Yeah, that's a very useful point. Thank you.